You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of
like
our
the KBOO Community Radio Facebook
on
page. Find KBOO Community Radio on Facebook and like our
FM.
Page and have events,
for tuning
ticket
in.
Giveaways, and great information delivered directly to your personal feed. One out of every seven humans is on Facebook, so using Facebook to share KBOO with your friends and family has never been easier. Like KBOO on Facebook today.
Thanks to COVID-19, many of us are spending more time outdoors than ever before. We're planting kitchen gardens, learning to identify trees, and taking up bird watching. In honor of all those life-giving walks we've been taking with friends, for this Earth Day, With Good Reason invites you to walk with us.
We're walking right at the edge of the forest here through the Phragmites. And it is thick. We're having to push the Phragmites out of the way. It's taller than we are.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today we're spending the entire show outdoors. Ryan Hewish is a professor of biology at the University of Virginia College at Wise. He was named an outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. We join him and his kids on a blustery early spring walk on their farm in the foothills of the Appalachians.
Oh yeah, it's a sycamore fruit. Look at that, it's falling apart.
Ryan, first tell me about where we're walking.
So we are on my own property. We're in Scott County, Virginia, and we're at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, a place called Appalachian Cove. Just walking through the forest with my family, learning about some of the plants that we've gotten used to eating and using as medicine.
Oh, look, here's a bloodroot that's blooming.
Wow, cool.
See how beautiful that is? It has those golden anthers on the inside.
Is this a farm?
Yeah, it's a forest farm and a homestead, so we have some cleared acres for our animals and for our vegetable gardens. But most of it is a forest farm where we steward wild native edible plants and medicinal plants.
How many animals do you have? What kind?
We have a lot of chickens, and we have dairy goats and livestock guardian dogs.
And as many children as animals?
Not quite. We have five children, ages ranging from 17 down to 4.
And a couple of them came along this tour with you.
Yeah. So all five of my children came with me. The older ones were kind of exploring on their own, but the younger two were the ones that were closest by my side.
That's a little waterfall. That's a big waterfall.
There's a big one up there, huh?
We have what we call daddy dates, right? And so my children, when they are younger, like to go on those nature hikes with me. So especially my younger two now. I remember one nature hike I took with my two youngest. I was walking through the forest with them, and we were just talking about the things that we're hearing and seeing. And I turned around. My youngest daughter, she was 3 at the time, she had picked a bouquet of leaves for me. And I looked down at them, and she had picked poison ivy. And so I just took her in the house and washed her hands with cool water and her goat milk soap. And then for good measure, I brought her back outside to introduce another plant that is used to treat poison ivy, which is jewelweed. And jewelweed, I call that Appalachian aloe, because it's when you crush it up, it just feels like a nice soothing aloe lotion. And so we made 2 poultices out of that, and we just smothered it on her hands, and she held on to those for a while. She didn't break out in a rash. And so in the past, when I've used this plant, the times when I applied the jewelweed poultice to my arm, I've never broken out in a rash.
Oh, here's one of my favorite springtime vegetables. This is wood nettle, Laportia canadensis. And it comes up, it's a tender green in the spring, and the leaves are very serrated, and they don't have as many stingers as the stinging nettle that many are probably familiar with. It's related to it, same family. But we clip off these young greens, and we just saute them, maybe steam them a little bit.
My earliest memories are of plants. For some reason, I've always had this close connection with plants. And I remember my grandmother, she's Swedish, and she would collect elderberries from the forest. And as I got older, when I became a teenager, I was just fascinated with plants, and I really got into foraging, right? Wild foraging and finding my own food. And my grandmother was the only one that would join me in my meals. I guess the rest of my family were scared about my adventures.
Daddy, look at those ones.
Oh yeah, these are toothworts.
Toothworts.
Yeah. They have four petals. That's one way we know they're in the mustard family. Oh look! Do those beetles fall out? The flower?
What beetle?
Those two little black beetles. I think they were pollinating the flowers.
Oh.
Look, these ones are already going to fruit. Should we taste one of the leaves? Good. When I learn plants myself, I like to use all my senses, and so that's what I try to do with my own children, with my students, is to smell them and to look at them, and sometimes they even make their own sound when you crinkle the leaves and kind of move them around like a piece of paper. They have their own unique sounds as well, and so often when my children are out, like my 3-year-old, she's now 4. She often just grabs plants and smells them. And I think that really helps to cement it in your mind. You know, as they say, the nose knows. It helps with those neural pathways to help remember.
Oh, you're right, more violets. Those are beautiful violets, huh? Here's crinkle root.
Crinkle root? Why is it called crinkle root?
Look at the roots and tell me.
Because it's crinkly?
It looks crinkly. And one reason why they call it Appalachian wasabi is because their roots taste like wasabi, which is really spicy. I'm going to taste it. Oh, that's good. It's kind of spicy. I know people who like to put this on their food and put it on their sushi. Some people like to pound it up and put it on their meat, add a little bit of salt to it. It's a very warm flavor, like a nice... nice warm mustard flavored wasabi.
A lot of these native plants, the origin of their uses came through the American Indians, right? So the indigenous cultures in the Appalachians, that's the people who first started using these. And then when the settlers came, they learned from them, and they kind of mix it into their own food ways as well. And so some of these tribal communities are trying to reclaim their food sovereignty, right? And so they're trying to learn more about these traditions and try to keep them alive.
And look how beautiful those flowers are too. Oh, we're almost to the waterfall. Man, could you imagine how many Troutleys are there out here, do you think?
I don't know. Probably a lot more than 100. Probably a trout lily.
I bet there's more than 1 million trout lilies here.
I bet
it's hard to count so much. Huh?
More than a million.
Oh, look. What's this?
Oh, spice bush?
Yeah. How would you describe spice bush for somebody who's never smelt it before?
Let me smell it. It smells...
Is it a good smell or a bad smell?
Kind of a... It's a spicy smell. It's like a...
It's a good one, though, right? Kind of like a mix between...
Yeah.
A ginger a little bit, maybe allspice.
Yeah.
It's the same family as cinnamon, but it doesn't really taste like cinnamon.
No.
But it does have a nice, pleasant flavor.
Yeah.
Remember when we put the branches and leaves in our lentil soup to flavor it?
Oh, yeah.
It gives it a nice, soft flavor.
It smells a little bit like sage, too.
Oh, good. Yep. You're right. It does smell like sage. And you can eat it, too.
I knew there was a little smell that really smelled like that, but I forgot the name. Then I remembered the sage.
Yep.
Can you believe how many trout lilies are out here?
Probably like a trillion. See all the ones you're probably stepping on?
So sometimes when I'm talking to people about certain plants, they have a name for the plant that I don't recognize. And so I start asking the question about what it looks like or what it's used for. And it's almost like a game where, you know, we're trying to guess what the other person is thinking of. And one of those stories is where a man was talking about a plant called shoemake. And he was talking about how it was used as medicine and as food, as kind of a spice. And I was so curious about this because I'd never heard of the plant shoemake before. And so I kept on asking questions, you know, about what else was it used for and how was it prepared, what part of the plant was used. Eventually I found out that he was referring to the sumac plant. And of course, you know, after you make that connection, you kind of hear that connection, right, with shoemake and sumac. I was very curious to find out where that name came from, because there's other relatives of sumac in the Middle East and Europe and other parts of the world that are more commonly used for spices and medicine. And so, you know, presumably when people come to this new area, to the new world, when they see plants that remind them of home, they apply a similar name to them and use them for similar purposes. And so in a way, when you document these names, you're also documenting that history that might be associated with it, and understanding that historical context and connection. And I think when people understand these connections historically and just the amazing stories behind it, it helps us be more connected with nature and with these individual plants and the species.
Are they trout lilies?
Uh-huh.
Trout lilies.
How did you know they're trout lilies?
Because they're like, they have like a ovalist shape leaf and they have like splotches on it.
Yeah, what color are the splotches?
They're like brown.
So I remember one time when I was hiking through our forest, I came across a population of vinca minor. That's a scientific name. Some people call it periwinkle. But of course, there's a lot of different plants with the name of periwinkle. It's evergreen. It's like a creeping vine along the ground. And it has these beautiful bluish purple flowers in the early spring. But I remember thinking this plant is not native to the area. But here I am in deep in the forest where there's no, you know, up on a hillside where I don't think there'd be any homes or any, you know, past gardens. And then as I kept on walking, I came up across some headstones and I realized that there was a cemetery there. And so I got to thinking about it and realized that people probably planted that there around the cemetery for the metaphorical connections to death and the possible eternal life and resurrection, you know, the symbol of a plant being evergreen and blooming in the early spring when everything else is dormant or dead. I didn't think much more about it until maybe a few weeks later. There was a professor of communications and Appalachian studies at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. We were talking about things, and she mentioned that she was trying to find out the identity of a certain plant called cemetery ivy. And as soon as she said that name, I thought, oh, she's probably talking about vinca minor. And she talked about how it was intentionally planted around cemeteries. And so now that I had that name, I was able to go do some research on cemetery ivy. And sure enough, there's other records about how people would intentionally plant this at cemetery sites long ago. And nowadays, when you're trying to find these cemeteries that might be overgrown with plants, one indicator is looking for the cemetery ivy. And that's how you can find some of these grave sites.
Could you imagine if you were a little chipmunk and lived out here? See all those holes in the side of the rocks by the roots? You can go out your front porch and see all those flowers. They're twice as big as you.
Yeah.
As an ethnobotanist, I understand and see this beautiful traditional knowledge associated with these plants. And sometimes when I talk to people about these plants, they say, oh, I wish you could have talked to my grandmother or my aunt or my grandfather. And they kind of lament the fact that they don't know as much as they did. And so it seems like these traditions and these associations and these relationships really with these plants are kind of disappearing, right? And that's one reason why we've proposed our research to try to document this. And the title of our research is called Appalachian Ethnobotany, Documenting Traditional Uses, Values, Stories, and Lexicon of Plants and Fungi Through Ethnographic Research. you know, it's basically we're trying to document this these rich ethnobotanical lore and values in Appalachia that might be dying, or at least kind of dwindling in complexity.
Oh, we don't want to step on these. Do you know what these are? These are anemone. Look at that. It looks like they have two arms reaching up with the head. There are so many wildflowers, huh?
Ryan Hewish is a professor of biology at the University of Virginia College at Wise. He was named outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. His family's forest farm and homestead is called Appalachian Cove. Sea level is rising faster on the Virginia coast than almost anywhere else in the world. And as it rises, it's creating what's known as ghost forests. Matthew Kerwin is the director of the Coastal Geomorphology and Ecology Lab at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science at William & Mary. He takes us to the Virginia coastline to walk into a ghost forest.
All right, we're heading out down the York River from Gloucester Point over to Goodwin Island to go check out some ghost forests on the island. It's a little bit breezy and choppy today, but not too bad. At least the weather's warm. I'm standing here in the middle of Goodwin Island, which is on the York River near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. And I'm standing on one of the higher parts of the island, which by Goodwin Island standards is actually only about 5 feet above sea level. When I look up above me, I see a pretty healthy looking loblolly pine forest. It looks much like bigger, healthier pine forest that you'd see a little further inland. When I look up into the trees, I see straight, tall trees without too many branches. The branches I do see have lots of green pine needles on them. In some cases, you can just barely see the sky because the canopy is so full. In many ways, it's a typical loblolly forest and appears to be healthy. But when I look at the ground, I can tell a slightly different story. When I look below, I see a lot of undergrowth. I see some greenbrier, some wax myrtle, some red bay, and of course a lot of pine needles. But there's almost no loblolly pine seedlings, even in places where there are gaps in the canopy and there should be enough light for new seedlings to grow. That means that when the trees around me die, there's nothing to take its place. And that's really the first big sign of a forest that's in trouble. It's not enough to have healthy adult trees. You need trees in the understory to take their place when they die. Now I'm going to walk towards the marsh. We're walking down elevation. We're walking downhill. It's so slight of a downhill that you can't really perceive it by just looking at it. But the vegetation actually changes quite a bit. You can tell that some of the loblolly pines are becoming more stressed. I see a few more dead branches. The loblolly pines themselves, despite being about the same age as where I was before, are now shorter and skinnier in diameter. And the understory is becoming thicker. Now you might think that a thick understory with lots of shrubs, lots of wax myrtle would be a good sign, but actually it shows that there's more light reaching the forest floor because the canopy of the trees is starting to diminish. And in fact, when I look up now, instead of seeing lush green canopy, I see a lot of sky. All right, now I'm walking continuing to walk downhill towards the marsh, towards the water. And I'm essentially at the boundary between forest and marsh. But what's really different about this is that instead of the kind of salt marsh that most people think of, I'm walking through a patch of what they call Phragmites. Phragmites is an invasive species. There is a native version in the Chesapeake Bay, but what we're walking through comes to us from China, and it is the first plant that replaces the forest that we're here. I don't know if you can hear me struggling to make it through the Phragmites. It is thick. It's taller than I am, in some cases maybe twice as tall as I am, and I'm having to push the stems out of the way to clear a path. All right, so I'm still in the Phragmites, but I'm getting close to the edge. I've walked about 100 yards from where most of the live green loblolly pines are, and now I'm standing in what we call a ghost forest. The ghost forest is marked by tall standing trees. The first ones I passed are trees that have just recently died from flooding of salt water. Probably came in on a real high tide or during a small storm. And I can tell they died recently because when I look at them, most of them still have their pine cones, and some of them still even have needles on them. The needles, of course, are brown instead of green. But as I walk away from the forest, I'm walking to places where the trees have been dead a longer time. Right now, I'm walking across a little pond. And now I'm back into, or I'm into native salt marsh. This is marsh grass called Spartina patens. Some people call it salt meadow hay. And there's still dead trees around me. This, where I'm walking was all forest not even 100 years ago. This is a marsh that was formed from sea level rise and saltwater intrusion. The land here in the Chesapeake Bay is sinking about twice as fast as it does in other places around the country. And at the same time, sea levels are rising, and the net effect is water levels that are increasing much faster than most other places in the U.S. and much faster than actually most places in the world. All right, so now I've walked about 300 yards from the modern forest, and I can see marsh as far as the eye can see. This is marsh now that's more than 150 years old. In some cases, it's up to a couple thousand years old. But even that formed as a result of sea level rise just a longer time ago. There's fiddler crabs running around on the mud in between the marsh plants. I see the first signs of spring on a salt marsh are the emergence of the fiddler crabs and a few new green shoots of a grass called Spartina alterniflora. It's the end of March now, but in a month or two, this marsh will be much greener instead of brown. And all of the critters will be a lot more active. Oh, this is neat. I'm walking up next to an eastern red cedar tree, and a cedar tree has been blown over by the wind. It's actually still alive, but its roots are completely uprooted from the ground below it, and they barely have any soil still attached to them, which means I can see every bit of the roots of this tree. And it's really interesting because the roots aren't growing in a circle in equal directions from the base of the tree. Instead, the roots are growing very much towards the closest source of fresh water, which is the upland forest. In other words, the roots are growing away from the marsh and away from salt water. They're in essence trying to find any fresh water that they can. One of my My lab manager, Tyler Messerschmidt, studied the root distributions of fallen down trees, and he's hypothesized that when the tree is trying to survive sea level rise by extending its roots in the uphill direction towards fresh water, he's hypothesized that it actually makes those trees more vulnerable to blowing over. This is something we see in cedar trees many times. The trees send their roots uphill towards fresh water, and as a result, become asymmetric and prone to toppling over in a windstorm. We see lots of fallen down, uprooted red cedar trees, whereas the loblolly pines tend to blow over up at the top and not uproot at all. As I look back from the marsh towards the forest, I see what looks like a wall of green. I'm looking over a wide, short marsh that's mostly brown this time of year. But when I look past the marsh, I see the green forest, and they're the low-lying coastal forests of coastal Virginia are mostly loblolly pine, which of course is green all year round and really stands out compared to the marshes surrounding them. But at the edge of that green forest, I can see lots of brown needles right at the edge of the forest where the marsh hits the forest. I see trees, some of which don't have any needles at all, but others where there are just a few live green needles on it, with a lot of missing needles and a lot of brown needles. I see little patches of brown and red colors on those surviving trees. And one of the coolest things is every now and then I'll see a live tree that's somehow surviving way out in the middle of the marsh. Passing one now that's at least 100 yards from the nearest big stand of trees. It's surviving pretty much on its own. It must be a little high spot that gets flooded just a little bit less time and maybe a little less salty. But for the most part, the marsh I'm walking across right now doesn't have any live trees remaining. As I walk towards the water, we're walking into marsh that's becoming older and older. And by the time I poke out to the edge of the marsh, we'd be looking at marsh that's about 150 years old. And at that point, the only sign of the forest that used to be there are not standing dead trees, but little stumps that are just barely poking out of the marsh surface. And if we kept walking even further, you'd have to look for those dead trees underneath the soil. If you took a shovel and dug a hole, there'd be a good chance you'd run into a dead tree branch or some roots, something like that.
Matt Kerwin is the director of the Coastal Geomorphology and Ecology Lab at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science at William & Mary. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Angel Garcia says his whole life has been about caves. He grew up in Puerto Rico, where caves hold a special cultural significance. And now he's a geologist at James Madison University. He journeys with us into the dark and cool depths of a cave. There, the eerie quiet is broken by drips of water that form stalactites and stalagmites. Garcia studies these cave sculptures and their drips to uncover mysteries from our planet's past.
Caves are really, really important part of the topography, part of the terrain in the Caribbean. For the people who were pre-colonial people, the Taino people, one of the creation stories, it is saying that there were two caves made by one of the spirits, and one of the caves that is called Casibajagua is where people like me, my family came from, right? in the other cave is where other people who are not like me came from, right?
Like me.
Yeah, you came from the other cave. That right. It's called Amayauna. But actually, in modern language, there is this saying that is just, it is making reference to that creation story, right? Is using in a context the word wagara, that is interpreted.